I'm going to try to talk very slowly because of this echo. And I hope that you hear less of this echo than I do. But if you can't understand me, I'll even slow down more. Though that's not my usual approach. I was asked to start with a little bit of introduction about myself and how I got involved in the subject. I'm a physician by training and really practice public health and preventive medicine, but I also did a psychiatry residency. And in my psychiatry residency, I worked primarily with the homeless and the chronic mentally ill. And it was in the early 80s, mid-80s, and it was at a time when if a patient came to us, if they had any kind of addictive disorder, and almost all of them had alcohol issues and many of them had drug issues, it was in the days of PCP, I was trained, if they have any kind of addiction problem, they have to get that trained before you can treat them. And that just didn't seem like the right answer to me. And after I finished my residency, I worked for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And in that position, I was in charge of the National Treatment Demonstrations, where we developed treatment programs for basically various cohorts of disadvantaged groups. We did, I was responsible for jails and prisons, ethnic minorities, women and children, and trying to decide how do you allow women to keep a relationship with their children. The Native Americans and others like that. And one of the components that was pretty much a unifying theme in what we did was including AA. Also, at any of our national meetings, we always had AA groups there for both the staff and as well as for the other participants. My last assignment before I retired from the Public Health Service, I was the Surgeon General of the Coast Guard. And in that capacity, I was in charge of both the medical piece as well as safety and work life. And the Coast Guard is a very small service, so one person does a lot of different things. And what was really exceptional about that is that on the work life side is where the prevention and the education and those components were, so we were able to incorporate it into the treatment side as well. And as those of you from the military know, AA is in sort of an unusual bucket because, and we'll get into that later, but if one goes into treatment, they get check marks against them. So you don't really want to call AA treatment, and in some ways it's not. But at the same way, you want to incorporate it and make it as available as possible for everyone. Currently, one of the things I do is I teach first-year medical students at Georgetown in an introductory course where they have to learn how to talk to people, because those people are going to be patients. They're going to interview patients. And one of the things that required is each of them has to attend at least one AA meeting. And it's very interesting when they come back from this experience. Well, first of all, it's interesting to talk with them about their hesitations and their fears and their feelings, just about how they might be accepted there. And it's extremely refreshing to hear the discussions when they come back. And I think that really does provide them with an understanding that they can share with their patients over their entire careers. So I really want to thank you as an organization, as a group of people, for all that you contribute. How many of you have a military background? I assume most of you. Okay. So in this case, you probably know more than I know about what I'm going to talk about. One of the things that I found about alcohol in the military is that there are no, this is the way it is. Commanders can do it this way or that way. The policies can be interpreted this way or that way. You know, it can be education, it can be treatment. And so everything that I'm going to say, some of you maybe have experienced in the same way, and some of you have probably experienced different. And I'm not trying to say this is the way it is. I'm trying to say it's sort of a little bit like this. And afterwards, or if we have time for discussions, if you want to take issue and explain how you experience things differently, I'm very, very, in fact, I think we're all very open to that. So the focus of my presentation is really going to be about alcohol and the military and the impact that AA has on that. One of the problems is that the culture of the military is really to encourage heavy alcohol use. But at the same time, if there's any kind of incidents or problems as a result of that use, draconian methods are often taken. So it's a very odd situation in that there's an encouragement of drinking in many ways, but at the same time there's little empathy if one has a problem as a result. The military policy describes alcohol and other drug abuse as a chronic relapsing condition, which I think it is, or can be. But at the same time, if one has a problem with alcohol, they're not given more than a second chance. And if they're given a problem with drugs, they're not even given a first chance. I was talking with one of the treatment counselors at the National, it's got its new name, but it's the old Walter Reed, old Bethesda. And she was saying that if a person tells her that she used marijuana once upon a time, that's grounds for being kicked out of the service. You know, that's the kind of world that it can be. And this can really lead to excessive stigma and risks for someone trying to take or seek any kind of care. And this is, I think, one of the most important things that AA has to contribute is the anonymity and the fact that people can go there, command isn't notified, command doesn't go. There's programs on base. You can go on base or you can go in the community. And certainly from what I understand, from the people I've talked to, the community is very receptive to seeing the military members in the local groups. Alcohol abuse is not only a stigma, but it does have this incredible career impact, and that really, really has a detrimental effect of people wanting to seek any kind of care. And confidentiality is not the rule in the military. There's almost always a requirement to notify command. For example, if someone goes to their doctor and the doctors are supposed to do screening, and if that doctor finds or suspects that there's an alcohol problem, that doctor refers the person for an evaluation and also is supposed to notify the command. That does not encourage people to be honest with their physicians or to seek help. The other thing is that one can go to a chaplain, and a chaplain isn't bound by that. So that there's a large group of support systems that have sort of evolved because of some of these policies. I was also on the Institute of Medicine's report on substance abuse in the military, and I think one of the sentences in it really summarizes the situation well. Heavy drinking is acceptable, while getting into trouble because of it is not. And most of the people that get help get it because of an incident. And an incident can be most anything. It can be DUI, a fight, family abuse, most anything. With the first incident, one gets an evaluation and begins a treatment program, ideally. And you're allowed two treatment episodes. And they can each be a year. It's a 12-month period of time. So you get two 12-month periods of time. And sort of how did we get to this situation? And I know one of the other speakers is going to talk a little bit more about the history of the policy. But sort of the first interest or one of the first interests that the military had was a 1967 task force to investigate alcohol and other drug abuse. And that resulted in a 1970 policy directive, which, quote, emphasized the prevention of alcohol and other drug abuse through education and law enforcement procedures focused on detection and early intervention. Treatment was provided for problem users with the goal of returning them to service. So at least there was that piece. The policy got updated in 1980, but this policy emphasized the incompatibility of alcohol and other drug abuse with military performance and readiness. It continued to emphasize education and training, but gave less emphasis to treatment. if any of you, and I'm probably about the only one here that's old enough to remember this, but I can remember when I was on active duty in Phoenix, and that was when they started all the urine drug testings, which later it was found that they weren't done right, and so a lot of the people that got discharged, those things had to be changed. But it was a very, very much an attitude of, we don't want you, you're out, which is not a productive attitude. Today, the military discourages alcohol abuse, particularly binge or heavy drinking, illicit drug and tobacco use. It's viewed a little bit more as a public health problem, but it's also viewed as a safety issue. And it's the safety issue piece that's often used as the reason why command has to be notified. And that's sort of what starts the issues then of that. I've been in certainly many discussions at both the VA and in high-level military situations where there's certainly more discussion now on the importance of providing a safe environment for people to go to seek help. And that in the end, that's probably going to have a more positive impact and actually reduce problems because you'll have less people that are abusing alcohol because they're afraid to seek help. One of the problems is the military really has an environment which promotes alcohol use. It's sort of a part of most recreation activities. It can be viewed as a reward for hard work, easing interpersonal tensions, and promoting unit cohesion. It's not easy to be the only one in the group that doesn't drink. The bases sell alcohol at reduced prices. There's happy hours and Friday nights at the club. If you're not part of that, you're often not viewed as being part of the team. It's also primarily a male-dominated environment. And granted, there has been less alcohol over time, and it may or may not be due to the fact that there, I think, is more of a female influence now, and it's a little bit less of an old boys' network. One of the problems that happens is during deployments, whether it was Vietnam or Iraq and Afghanistan, they tend to increase the use of substances. In Vietnam, it was a lot of the opiates and opium because that's where it was growing. In Iraq and Afghanistan, in addition to alcohol, there's a serious problem with prescription drug abuse, which is really an iatrogenic problem. That was another subject that the Institute of Medicine really looked at. Let's talk a little bit about the data. Based on the Institute of Medicine's report, and these are data that came from the Department of Defense, about 44% of people 25 or younger have admitted to at least occasional binge drinking. Or I'm backwards here. 44% of those that are heavy drinkers or admit to being, and this is all self-report, heavy drinkers, which is five drinks or more at least one night a week for a month. 44% are 25 years or younger. 44% are not married. 85% are male, 15% female, which is more or less the male-to-female ratio in most of the services. 80% have a bachelor's degree or less. 70% white, which includes 10% Hispanic, and 17% African-American. Alcohol abuse or heavy alcohol use varies among the services, but it's consistent with the service demographics. For example, the rates of heavy alcohol use are highest in the Marines, but at the same time, the Marines have the highest proportion of young males. And so it's not really a service-related thing. It's more due to the general demographics. About 15 to 20% of the active duty admit to heavy alcohol use in the past 30 days. Binge drinking has increased to almost 50% from about a third to half during the 1998 to 2008 time period. The number of treatment bed days attributable to alcohol use has quadrupled from 2001 to 2010. And that may be due to the availability of services, or it may be due to the patient population. I think it's hard to say. The highest rates are in people who are single, next, those not living with their spouses, and the rates are lowest of those living with spouses. Again, it's not different than the demographics in the rest of the country. Overall, active duty military have higher rates of heavy alcohol use than does the civilian population, and that's particularly true of those 35 years of age and younger. So I think that, how is my time? I've got 5 minutes. Okay, I just want to make sure I have my things here. I almost never give a talk with sheets of paper, and you can tell I am not used to my sheets of paper. But in any case, so what are the basic policies? And you get more information on this now. So what happens? If someone can be identified, can self-identify as having an alcohol problem. In the Marines, it's about 10% of those in treatment, and in the Army, it's about 15%. So there's a little bit of difference, not that much. When one goes into treatment, a treatment plan, there's an evaluation and a treatment plan is developed, and in most of the services, people are recommended to go to AA. That becomes a part of the official treatment plan. But though it's part of the official treatment plan, a person cannot be forced by the military to go. It's still a voluntary activity. And I think you're all familiar with the issues of do you really go and getting check marks and sheets of paper, and we're not even going through all that stuff. If one self-identifies as having an alcohol problem and goes to AA that way and it becomes sort of known by command, that can be called education. And education doesn't count against you. However, if you later have an incident, that episode of education can then be counted as the second strike because you've already tried once. So it becomes a very a punitive sort of situation. There's other places that people can go for help, which frequently include which lead to a referral to AA. I mentioned the chaplains, which are confidential. There's medical, which has to report to command. There's HR, which probably isn't where people are going to go. There's also the employee assistant program. And in the Coast Guard, we utilize that a lot because the employee assistance program is a program, it's really like the civilian world, that all the services participate in. And someone can, there's an 800 number to call, and you can call that number, get like 6 counseling sessions and get referrals to other places. And those EAP programs can refer to AA. And those are very confidential. I don't think that they're used in the other services as much as they are in the Coast Guard, primarily because the Coast Guard is so scattered around, we don't have local services where we are. So I think that's, save my time for questions.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
Good morning. First off, I'm a Veterans Administration employee, so I need to disclose that my opinions are not necessarily the opinions of the U.S. government, the Public Health Service, the Department of the Army, which I worked for 4 years. They are simply my opinions. Second thing is that I have no conflicts to report. That means that nobody pays me to say the things I say, which is a good thing. There's a scene in a movie called Planes, Trains, and Automobiles where John Candy and Steve Martin are driving on a road and a person next to them rolls their window down and says, "Hey, you're going the wrong way." And John Candy is incredulous. He looks at Steve Martin. He says, "How do they know which way we're going?" So he yells out to the person. He says, "Hey, mind your own business." And then they realize they're in the wrong lane of a highway, driving into traffic. Now, that's the theme we're going to start off with. One of the things I realized working with the military is that they really don't like quizzes. So I'm going to give you a quiz. I want everyone to pay attention. But I'm going to do you a big favor. The answer to every question is 8%. What percent of the U.S. population drinks half of all the alcohol in the U.S.? He's right, 8%. What percent of the U.S. population smoke half of all the tobacco? 8%. Obviously, 92% smoke the other half. What percent of the U.S. population loses half of all the gambling losses in the United States? 8%. Starting to see a theme here. Despite General Order Number 1, what's General Order Number 1? No alcohol downrange. Despite General Order Number 1, what percent of the U.S. military population drinks to the point of intoxication every week downrange? And it actually is higher in certain groups. Special forces is higher, things like that. Now, if the U.S. population, about 10% of the population, has a significant disorder that we call addiction, alcoholism or drug dependence, and if the U.S. military is a cross-section of the U.S. population, why are we surprised that we have an issue of alcohol and substance use disorders in the military? It should not be a surprise. Now, in Vietnam, one-third of the military who were experienced in combat used heroin. We are now fighting a war in a place that grows 90% of the heroin for the entire world. We also have, thanks to organized medicine, a protocol in medicine that requires us to ask you how much pain you're in. Pain is still the number one reason that active duty service members seek any service from a medical provider. That's different, by the way, than the general population. Pain is the number one reason that military seek a contact with a medical provider. So you're asked, what's your pain level today? Then you're asked, where's your pain? How bad your pain? What's the quality of your pain? And then we also say, we're going to give you something to make your pain better, and then we have to reassess. We have increased the amount of opioids prescribed to the military by 500% over the past 15 years. That means there's five times as much Vicodin, Percocet, OxyContin being used for military staff. Now, we have a high rate of injury in the last war that we're in right now, the OEF and OIF. High rate of injury. High rate of musculoskeletal injury. And the musculoskeletal injuries can be from acute events, bullet wounds, mortars, things like that, or from chronic events, wearing 65 pounds of armor, a rucksack and a weapon and a helmet, and then going on 9-mile missions. And so almost everybody we took care of at Fort Belvoir had bad knees and bad back. And that was the routine, not the exception. Now, as we start looking at this, we need to, like John Candy, we need to know where we're coming from to know where we're going. So I'm going to go backwards in time. In the early 1800s, there was a family in Virginia that moved out to Missouri. That family was called the Still family. Dr. Johnson and I are both osteopathic physicians, and people always say, what is an osteopath? What is that? So we're going to talk a little bit about that and its relationship to the military and to AA. The Still family was interesting because they were abolitionists. Missouri was a slave state. In the 1850s, there was a balance in the U.S. Congress of slave versus non-slave states. Because they were abolitionists, they were kicked out of Missouri. They were Methodist ministers. They were kicked out of Missouri, and they went to the free state of Kansas, which was not yet a state. It was going to become a state. And there was a huge battle going on. Kansas was called Bloody Kansas because John Brown was in Kansas before he went to Virginia. And there was a lot of things going on that created conflict, the pro-slavery and the anti-slavery forces. When the Civil War broke out, Andrew Taylor Still, one of the Still family, was a MD. He was a physician. He was a surgeon in the U.S. military, a major, and he was captured by the Confederates. He provided medical services to everyone who came to him. They released him, and then he continued to practice. He had a very interesting concept that he wanted to create, and it was to develop a new way of medicine. I remember back in the 1800s, 70% of people who had surgery died from infection or from complications of anesthesia, which was ether. They did have morphine, at that point in time, so they could do lots of different types of surgery. But the thing that was really a critical factor in this is that people typically didn't do well. Most of the medicines were patent medicines. Most of the things that were provided to people actually hurt them. So he developed a philosophy, and the philosophy is based on five things. Number one, the body has an inherent ability to heal itself. Now, that's an important concept, that you yourself have an ability to heal. He didn't believe that doctors healed people. Healing, he was a very religious family. He felt that healing on the part of a person to another person was a gift from God, but that not every person had it and not every doctor had it. So the person themselves had a greater chance of healing themselves. Number two, all medicines are poisons and should be used in the smallest effective dose. Well, that would come back to haunt us in regard to opioids. Number three, surgery should be avoided until no other option exists. Now, that's an interesting concept because I look at the number of 25-year-olds that I take care of who already had back surgery, and unfortunately, back surgery is not a final endpoint for most of our patients that have chronic back problems. Number four, every disease affects the entire person. When you break your leg, it does not just affect your muscle and your bones. It affects your urology, in other words, your ability to urinate. It affects your circulation. It affects your nervous intervention and how you feel things. It affects your sexuality. It affects your finance. It affects your emotions. And the number five was, since the body is 70% muscle, bone, and sinew, grizzle, every disease affects the musculoskeletal system too. Now, MDs and DOs have been fighting back and forth since 1892 when the DO started their first school. The military, the U.S. Army, gives 80 scholarships per year to budding physicians. This is how we recharge our batteries in regard to medical force in the U.S. Army. 40 of those go to the DOs, 40 go to the MDs. There are 34 DO schools. There's 129 MD schools right now. So it's rather interesting that osteopathic medicine has had a role in the care of the military, too. 1895, a man was born whose name was Bill Wilson. When he was 8 years old, his father absconded and left the family. His mother, Edith, told the kids, Dorothy and Bill, Mama's going to go to school. So she left the family with her parents, and she went to the Boston School of Osteopathy. She became an osteopathic physician. Bill's never had a good relationship with his mother, and a lot of that, I think, probably went back to abandonment feelings of what was going on. In his adolescence, he started drinking. There was an event going on in Europe called World War I, and Bill Wilson volunteered to go. He got married in his uniform before he left. Now, as it turns out, war is not a good thing. No matter how you cut it, war is not a good thing. So what did Bill's drinking habits do when he went through the war and then came back? Did they get better? No, they got much, much worse. The reality is it got considerably worse. And the story that Bill had when he would talk about his history is that he, no matter how many times he wrote letters to his wife, I promise to you, I swear to God, and AA has all these letters, that the bottle will never touch my lips again. And it went on for years of how he felt this terrible pain, but he could not stop it on his own. Bill Wilson's brother-in-law also is an osteopathic physician, Leonard Strong. And Leonard Strong paid for Bill Wilson's admission to the Towns Hospital under Dr. Silkwood three times to go into a treatment. Now, the treatment back then is kind of interesting because AA actually has the receipt. It was $125 for 8 days of detox. But in the 1930s, that was a lot of money. And Leonard Strong became the treasurer for AA. He was a Class A member for many years for AA. He actually didn't pass away until 2005 in Rutledge, Vermont. Now, I grew up on the west coast of Michigan. All my relatives are blueberry farmers. Went to a small college, Hope College. Went to medical school at Michigan State. Even though my friend here is a U of M grad, and my wife of 37 years is also a Wolverine, we're still standing. We can work together. Now, I go off to Chicago for my residency and did a fellowship in Chicago, and I go into practice under the Public Health Service, and I inherit a group called Kaleidoscope. Now, Kaleidoscope sounds like such a wonderful thing, doesn't it? Multicolored, and it's pretty, and it's interactive. It was 256 teenagers who had failed 13 foster home placements, and they were in a special program. All of them were addicted to cocaine, heroin, alcohol. Most of them were prostituting on the sides, on the streets in North Chicago and in the central Chicago area. And what happened was, is I said, I got to learn about this because I didn't know much about treating drug addiction, despite lots of formal education. And so I went ahead and took every course I could find in addiction medicine. And by the mid-1980s, I ran into a woman who was an amazing person at a meeting. Her name was Ruth Fox, and she was a New York addictionologist. I didn't know such things existed. I got very involved with an organization that became the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and she said something that really moved me. There's no greater gift that we have than to give hope to the hopeless. And as I was working with a lot of these kids, I realized they were hopeless. And in 1985, the HIV antibody test came out. I had 56 teenagers who were positive for HIV in 1985. That my population grew up to over 700 while I was practicing in Chicago. In 1982, I get a telephone call. I was going into practice, and it was from Father Jim. And Father Jim said, I understand you do house calls. I said, well, yeah, I do house calls. It's something I plan to give for my patients, because when I checked off all the little boxes, what I'm willing to do, I checked off every box there was. House calls, sliding scale, here for free, Saturday hours. You know, I wanted to be busy. And he said, well, I have a patient here for you. I said, well, that's amazing, because today's my first day of opening my practice. And he said, well, we're at California and Harrison on the west side of Chicago. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm at Mount Sinai. I'm just a mile away from you. Let me come over there when I'm done. So I drive over at 7 o'clock, and there's a line 3 blocks long. And I walk up to the door, and this is back in the days where I wore a white coat, and I was 175 pounds. And I get out, and this mass of people open up and make a line for me to walk down. And I walk in, I come up to this big door the size of a garage door. I pound on the door, and it's like the Wizard of Oz. A little teeny door opens up. I said, hi, I'm Dr. Decker. Father Jim wanted me to come by. And I walk in, and Father Jim says, oh, good, doctor, come over here. Now, there's a room this size. Attached to another room this size, there were 280 beds in the room. Now, these are not the regular beds you're thinking of. These are the old Catholic hospital metal beds that had a crank in the bottom of them and a big metal thing. They're the size of a Buick. And if you can imagine, 240 beds. So I'm taking care of this patient. He had venous stasis ulcers. He had just been released from Cook County Hospital. And interestingly enough, he, like half of homeless men in this country, was a veteran. And I say, Father, he just needs to eat a lot of protein, so give him beans, give him meat, keep his legs elevated, and every day just gently wash this off and then keep it wet to dry, and he'll be better in about a month. And I pick my head up, and all these people coming in from the outside. And I look at Father Jim, and I say, Father, this guy's all taken care of. Who takes care of the rest of these people? And there's a big smile on his face, and he says, well, we were hoping you would. Now, I know my wife must love me, because I dragged her down there every Tuesday night for 14 years. And over the course of those 14 years, the only person who was paid was my receptionist, who I said, we have to have a note on everybody. Everybody gets a note. And so Dolores was the only one that got paid. Well, she kept track of everything, and we saw over 34,000 visits over 14 years. Now, what's interesting about that is that we had students from all 7 medical schools coming in and volunteering, and the rule was, you get to come and see patients and take care of them who really need their care, but you have to steal something from your hospital to come here. So we had everything, and it worked out beautifully. Now, in 1994, my wife and I leave Chicago, and Father Jim comes up to me and he says, Dr. Decker, All the brothers and the priests have talked about this, and we would like to make you a member of the Franciscan Order. I said, well, Father, I'm moved and I'm honored, but you know I'm a Methodist. And he says, well, do you believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ? I said, well, of course I do. He says, no. He says, you know, for us Catholics, it's pretty serious. There are seven things that we must do. I said, really, what are those? He says, well, this is in Matthew 25. We must give water to the thirsty. We must feed the hungry. We must clothe the naked. We must shelter the homeless. We must visit and heal those who are sick. We must, I find this very interesting, that it's said in the Bible, visit those in prison. And the seventh, which is my personal favorite, we must teach the ignorant. Now, I said, that's it? That's all it takes to be a Catholic? I said, I'm all in. And he says, well, no, it's more complicated than that. I mean, we actually have to have the vicar recognize you, and you have to become a member of the order. Now, the Franciscans don't believe in air conditioning. Chicago in June is a hot, muggy place like Atlanta. So they're in these thick wool robes, and I'm in a suit. And I'm the sixth person that day. So I've been sitting in this muggy room for about 4 hours, listening to the five people ahead of me go through the process and show their verification that they are members of the Catholic Church. So I get up there finally, and the vicar's worn out and sweaty, and I'm sweaty, and he says, okay, where's your paperwork? And Father Jim steps up, and he says, Dr. Decker's from the state of Michigan, and they're not real good on paperwork. And he looks at me, and I say, well, sir, I think it's important for you to know. And then Father Jim says, Dr. Decker, do you believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ? I said, of course I do. And I rattle off the seven things we're supposed to do, and the vicar's looking at me, and I said, sir, I think we should probably tell you that I'm a Methodist. And he says, all Christians are Catholic. Make a certificate with a small C. Done. So as it turns out, I am the probably the only non-Catholic member of the Order of Franciscan Monks. Now, that's an important step to note, because the next thing that happens is we get recruited to the Indian Health Service, which was 12 years of a very good part of our lives in Arizona. And the common denominator for American Indians, sadly, is poverty, is high rates of injury, and unfortunately very high rates of alcohol and substance abuse. And so the expertise I was developing in addiction medicine were challenged, and we continued to go. I became the national consultant for addiction medicine for the Indian Health Service. In 2010, I was recruited by Lieutenant General Robb to come to the U.S. Army and set up a treatment program for the U.S. Army. And it was an interesting concept, because General Robb and the Pentagon, Admiral Mullins and some of the other people in the Joint Chiefs, felt very strongly that we have a problem with the graduates of OIF and OEF in regard to substance use disorders. And it was progressively getting worse, and it had a very, very close relationship with suicidal events and with depression. And mental illness has become a significant part of a recognized problem in the military and a high need for intervention services. The problem was the treatment of addiction in the military was not very successful. It resulted in people being discharged from the military. We did a study of 101 service members in the Capital Med area in 2010 who were sent to private facilities. These private facilities are all across the country. The U.S. government pays $35,000 per person to get treated. That was in 2010. In 2011, we looked at those people in 2010 to find out, were they still in the military? There were 9 out of 101 that were still in the military. 9. Most of them because they had failed. In other words, they had failed a tox screen or they had a relapse. Now, if you grow up in the military and you know that wake up is at 04:45 and that you will be ready to get out at 5 o'clock in the morning, do your PT, come back at 6:30, take your shower, do all the things you need to do, and you're sitting in the mess hall or the DFAC at 0700, there's a certain routine you go through. You get used to it. If in the private facility someone walks in at 9 o'clock and says, George, would you like to go to group therapy right now? Well, actually, I'm going to do horseback riding today, and I think I'm going to take today off. And unfortunately, in a lot of programs, it's, well, we don't really want to push you too hard, but we'd like you to come to the meeting. Well, when I have a first sergeant walk in your morning and say, hey, it's 0500, where are you going? Get up! Now, it does make a difference. And so a military model in treatment had a very high rate of success. We followed 261 people who went through the program, and at 24 months, we only had 12% fail. The other 88% were still in the system, and they were still doing well. And I stay in touch with many of the people who went through that program. Now, as it turns out, on July 5th of this year, I got sideways with a new command that came in, and I was politely told, you're not wearing a uniform, you have 102 people that report to you, that's not a right system, I want you out. And on February 9, I was fortunate that the Flagstaff, the VA in Prescott assigned me to Flagstaff, and so I'm working with the 1,400 vets that live in the mountain there, and I'm proud to do that. But the reality is, there is a huge need for treatment in the military for substance use disorders. Now, when General Torelli and Admiral Mullins said, what do you actually do? What do you actually do with these patients? And I said, sir, you need to understand something. All I am is an agent of change. That's all I do. There's nothing magical about treatment. I had a Special Forces sergeant tell me, who is very disturbed, Doc, I don't have enough real estate to rent you space in my head. I said, listen, I'm going to do everything possible to get in your head, because you're not going to get better. People don't change unless they become uncomfortable. Does that sound familiar? They don't change unless they become uncomfortable. We had a guy in our unit whose job was to make people uncomfortable. And he did a wonderful job doing that. He would get under their skin, because we had lots of people who didn't think they had a problem. You got to remember, 85% of the people who have alcoholism do not think they have a problem. So what happens is that something has to happen to wake them up. And so it's a wake-up call when you come to us. And I would tell people, listen, I believe in my heart and soul you have a disease that will kill you. And it will break the hearts of every person who loves you. And unfortunately, we've already had 5 of our graduates die. All of them have died because of the disease. So there's no doubt that there's an impact of the 651 people we treated. But that's still a small number compared to the rate of death. I mean, when you look at heroin addiction, Afghanistan produced over 6,000 metric ton of heroin in 2014. I'll say that again, over 6,000 metric ton. That's more heroin than every heroin addict in the world can use in a year. So what has happened to the price of heroin? It dropped like a rock. In Phoenix right now, you can buy a gram of uncut black tar heroin for $40 a gram. That's unheard of. Kids can support a heroin habit with their lunch money. 20% of heroin addicts kill themselves every year. So when we start talking about treatment, treatment works, but treatment also fails. I want to tell you about 2 people. One was a young man who walks into our unit. We had 5 admissions on this day. It was crazy. I was seeing his agent doing his history and physical at 8 o'clock at night. He walks into the room and he bursts into tears. And he says, I said, listen, it's hard to come on this unit. There's a lot of stigma that you have when you get here. I can be understanding. We want to support you. And he said, no, that's not it, Doc. You don't remember. I said, what don't I remember? He says, you don't remember that you were my professor in med school. He had been one of my students. He had a HPSP scholarship, the Health Profession Student Program scholarship. He went to Walter Reed for his residency in anesthesia. As it turns out, we work doctors hard, just like we work soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors hard. And what happened was he started using fentanyl. Fentanyl is a highly addictive drug that's highly available in the anesthesia department. He turned himself in, said, "I need help." This was 2007, so they sent him to Fallujah as a general medical officer. As it turns out, it was a bad tour. The unit he was in, a mortar hit the roof. The roof did not get penetrated, but it knocked him out because he was right underneath the impact site. And so he had a TBI. He was recovering. In 2013, December, his wife left him and took the two kids and went back to Mississippi. What did that put him in danger of?
Relapse.
He relapsed. He turned himself in. He had been sober. He had been sober from 2007 to 2014. He turned himself in, asked for help, went through our program, did fantastic, did absolutely fantastic. Started an on-site AA meeting at Aberdeen, was doing everything in the right way, but it caught up with him in November of 2014 when his command said, "You know, that's actually your second treatment. We know you have 16 years in. We're going to give you the opportunity to resign your commission and leave." 2 days before he was supposed to leave, he ended his life. The second story I want to tell you about is a colonel named Eric, who was at Andrews. He was a wonderful, wonderful, incredibly brilliant man who had severe alcoholism. He was in a TS clearance situation. He spoke 9 languages. He was an amazing person. But he had put all of his pictures out. He had 9 tours as an airman from Sarajevo all the way through Afghanistan, and he was going to end his life. My wife ended up taking care of him in a psych unit. He went through our treatment program. He called me up 2 days ago. He's been 2 years sober. He gets his daughters for the summer. He's out of the military right now. He's working a job that uses all of his talents. And he said, "You know what? I will not miss a meeting because..." And he said something as an airman that made all the sense in the world. "If I'm not moving forward, I'm falling." And I said, "Wow, as a pilot, that makes all the sense in the world." He said, "The thing that moves me forward is knowing that this circle of fellowship keeps me alive." And he said, "I'm happy to do that." I appreciate you listening. AA is a critical part of the success of everyone I've treated. Now, I've treated a lot of people who say, "AA's not for me. I don't like to talk. People don't know my business. They don't understand me. They were never there." And unfortunately, that's the population that doesn't make it. Now, it's important for us. I mean, one of the things that I see AA as something that's important to me because it's a guide to living. Only one step even says alcohol. But the thing that's important is that it doesn't work unless people are encouraged, welcomed, and sustained in that situation. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Don Reichert. I am the retired Director of Policy for the Army Substance Abuse Program. I met Joyce yesterday, and she was a little nervous because she was saying, "Oh, my God, what's this guy going to do talking about Army policy?" You know, and, yeah, I'm a walk or a wank or whatever they call the thing. So I want to give you a little bit of my background, but first I have to do the same thing. Sorry. Have to do the same thing that my big book fell. The same thing that Tony said. Yes, I work for the federal government, but believe me, I do not represent the federal government, and anything I say is my own personal opinion and not the United States Army. Let me talk a little bit about myself. Okay. When I was growing up in Hammond, Indiana, and those of you who know where Hammond is, it's the place where Gene Shepard did the Christmas Story and all of that. My grandfather, during Prohibition, owned a restaurant on the Indiana-Illinois border in Chicago. So the restaurant was on the Illinois side in Chicago, and their house was on the Indiana side, and they had a covered porch that went between the two of them. Now, my grandfather bought what was called near beer. During Prohibition, they had beer that had less than 0.5% or 1% alcohol. And he would buy pure grain alcohol from Al Capone, and then they would needle the beer kegs. So if the Chicago police came, or the Illinois state cops, they'd roll the beer bottles over to the Indiana side. If the Indiana police came, they'd roll the beer bottles over to, or the beer kegs over to the Illinois side. But when Elliot Ness or the feds came, they'd break up the beer bottles because they had joint jurisdiction. I'm 9 years old, and I'm watching The Untouchables for the first time. And I look at my mother in utter disbelief and say, "You mean Al Capone is the bad guy and Elliot Ness is the good guy?" You know, in your family, well, we have a saying in my family, alcoholism doesn't run in my family, it gallops. And for some lucky reason, I was not, I guess I got in the program and I wasn't hit. But my father was an alcoholic, my mother was an alcoholic, and I've had experiences at 13. Yesterday I called my cousin Sheila. Sheila C. is celebrating her 46th year of sobriety on the 20th of July. She lost her house. They lost their business. She was at ends with. Normally, alcoholic wives, their husbands leave them. Her husband did not. So the night Armstrong landed on the moon, she called AA. And she was telling me this yesterday, and she was saying, you know, I called, and then I said, well, why did I do this? And somebody knocked on the door. And she didn't want to answer. But she looked outside, and she said they looked so nice and clean, like normal people. So she let them in, and she went to her first meeting. And she wound up in the substance abuse program, and it was a very, very a great success story. I wish I could say that with the rest of my family. I'm having dinner tomorrow with another cousin whose son has gone through 15 rehabs. Yeah, go figure. And as Joyce said, what's the 16th going to do? I don't know, you know. But, you know, we have to hope and pray that it's going to do that. So how did I get into this field? Well, I was a adjutant general officer in Kaiserslautern, West Germany at the time. And I had a commander who, like Tony was talking about, I had a commander who I had a problem with, and he asked me to leave. And so the only job that was available was the alcohol and drug control officer in Kaiserslautern. Well, I took it, and what happens back then, because there were a lot of military in the drug and alcohol program, and those who weren't in the treatment side but on the admin side, they were usually throwaways. So you only had two places to go. You could, you know, go to the bottom or head to the top. Well, for some reason, I don't know what happened, but within a year, they called me, and I was in Heidelberg with the agency, and I was doing inspections and doing a lot of different things going around Europe, which was great. I really enjoyed it. Come back after 11 years, got out, but then I came back in. So last year, I spent was my 40th year in the military, got out, and am now, you know, with my wife doing our thing. But we really enjoy the military, and it's really a neat thing. Now, the subject of this is AA and as a resource to the military. The military sometimes has a passive-aggressive feeling with AA. And let me give you an example. I was on an inspection with a friend of mine, and he opened up his wallet. We were going through TSA security, and I see this coin in his wallet. And look at him, and I just smile, and I say, "Friend of Bill W.?" And he looks at me in utter shock, and he says, "Please don't tell anybody. Please." I said, "Your anonymity is absolutely with me." I said, I'm sorry I asked. He said, no. He says, "But I don't want anybody to know." I said, "That's fine. You know, that's fine." You know, we actually have a thing in our regulation that talks about people who are in sobriety. And I've had, over the years, I've had many counselors and educators who were recovering alcoholics, who fell off the wagon, if they were in a treatment program as a clinician, they had to get out of the program. We call them impaired providers. But then they had to move into an education or whatever. And they came back, and some of them were some of our best counselors. I remember hiring people way back when we used to have a 101 series, which is one of the GS series, which is for paraprofessionals who were mainly recovering alcoholics in AA. I brought the big book, you know, y'all seen this, because when I talk to people about the big book, within the first two pages, I found that Bill W. was a soldier, a biker, and a risk taker. Okay? Now, I was a soldier, I'm a biker, and Lord knows, my wife knows I'm a risk taker. And why I say that is that we a lot of times, you know, all right, read the first 164 pages of the book, you know, and many times we make our counselors do that because we send people to AA and they have no concept of what AA is. So AA is what I call a confidential support system for our military. Okay? We have a system right now called KTEP. It's called the Confidential Education, Alcohol Treatment and Education Pilot. And it started on 3 sites, it's moved to 9, and we have tried to get this program into the Army full time. We are having a very, very difficult time doing that because the lawyers, you know, and you know what Shakespeare said about lawyers, the lawyers say, well, we can't, the commander has to know about the program. Look at what happened at Washington Navy Yard. And we said, okay, he was a contractor, he had a clearance, and he was crazy. That doesn't mean he was an alcoholic, and that doesn't mean that the command. But so it's not getting through. But, you know, and many people in our program, in our drug and alcohol program, are very sad about that. And I continue to say to people, now, first of all, I will be the first to admit that AA is not treatment. I understand that. But if a soldier wants sobriety, the first place they should look at is AA. AA is on every military installation. It's on the outside of every military installation, it seems, everywhere. And if a soldier really wants to stop drinking, then they should start at AA. Now, we understand that some people need much more treatment than that, and that's fine. And maybe when they join AA, they will see their problems, or their sponsor will, and they will get additional professional help. But when a soldier tells me, well, I don't want to go to AA, and I go, why? And they said, well, I don't like that spiritual stuff. I said, okay, well, what about, you know, do you not believe in a higher power? Well, yeah, but, you know, they keep pushing it. It's like religion. I said, okay, have you been to an AA meeting? Well, no, but that's what everybody tells me. My cousin, who I'm having lunch tomorrow with, said to me, Don, if only my son could become a functioning alcoholic. That's a pretty low bar, okay? And for him, it's a really low bar because he's living at home at 57 and she's passing out booze every day to him because she doesn't want him to go to the liquor store. So, but, you know, that happens. I mean, it just, that happens. So let me talk a little bit about the regulation. Interestingly enough, you know, this is one of the first regulations for the Army Substance Abuse Program, Circular 685. Those of you who look at the paper, back in the early 70s or before the early 70s, Army or the U.S. government used to print on 8 by 10.5 paper, which was a half an inch shorter on each side. And I worked in an Army printing plant one time, and we were switching over. I said, well, why did they do that? They said, well, it was for two reasons. One, you know, the standard is 8.5 by 11. Well, two reasons is, one, that they found that they could put just as many words in most letters or whatever on this same size paper. But two is that government bureaucrats couldn't steal the paper because it was a different size if they took it home. So go figure, I know. So this is one of our first regulations. And interestingly enough, they talk about AA. They talk about the AA pamphlet in terms of, is AA for you? And that's in the first part of our regulation under alcohol voluntary. The second part talks about self-help methods. And Alcoholics Anonymous has an entire paragraph on that, which is great. You know, so we looked at AA thing. They also have a paragraph on transcendental meditation, and you know how far that's gone. But, I mean, so the Army was connected to AA first and thing. Now, we have a total of 11 different iterations of our regulation. Of all of those 11, only the 1976 regulation doesn't talk about it. And we don't know why. You know, it just popped up there. But the rest of the regulations do. Now, sometimes it's a very strong statement about AA, and sometimes it's a kind of a weaker statement about AA. But for the last 15 years, the last four iterations, it's basically saying, as a part of rehabilitation treatment, the soldier will be encouraged to attend and participate in AA or other self-help groups. Rehabilitation will be will specify an appropriate number of meetings per week to the client and where they were encouraged to attend. Under no circumstances will self-help groups be required to provide names of members. Participation in self-help organizations cannot be used as sole criteria for rehabilitation success or failure. And unit commanders and ASAP staff should become familiar with self-help organizations. That's a pretty good thing. Now, that last line I say is very critical because our program, or the Army program, has the command involvement. If a soldier broke his leg, no one would, you know, Dr. Tony or Joyce, no one would call and the commander and say, well, should I use an air splint or should I use plaster Paris? Should I use Percocet or Darvan for a painkiller? All of that's decided at the hospital. But in our Army substance abuse program, the commander has to make a decision in terms of treatment. Does the soldier go into what we call track one, which is just an education phase, track two, which is an outpatient, or track three, which is a residential inpatient with outpatient afterwards? Okay. Too often, our counselors don't see the commander for the first time until they decide what's going to happen with the soldier. And so I encourage our counselors to go out and educate commanders. Because if commanders are going to make the decision, they have to be informed. You know, they know beans and bullets and, you know, all of that stuff. Most of them don't know the treatment of alcoholism. And so we have to work with commanders on that. And we've been very successful with that. Now, let's talk about a call to action. What can you in this audience do with AA in the military? The first thing I believe you can do is support your local installations if you have an installation nearby. Every installation has an AA chapter or a meeting, usually on post. Many have several on post. But there are soldiers that are not comfortable with this. Okay? I know when I went to Belgium, Roger in the front row was there, and I came to a meeting early, and I said to Roger, Roger, I says, I don't want to come to this meeting. I understand it's an open meeting, but I don't want to come to this meeting because I don't want people to be uncomfortable because they know who I'm at. I was the alcohol and drug control officer. I will come back next week. You can tell the folks, if they don't want to see me, stay away. And he kind of looked at me, and I'm not sure the exact thing, but he says, they don't care, but that was fine. So the next week I came, and I basically said, you know, we're here to help, okay? Now, I'm getting more of the bargain than you are because I get big books from you, I get pamphlets from you, I get sponsors from you. But, you know, if there's anything we can do, let us know. So about 6 months, I guess, later, Roger called and says, they're trying to throw us out of the Religious Education Center. Can you do something? And so I said, you're always welcome to be with us, but, you know, I understand why you'd want to be in the Religious Education Center. I'll talk to the head priest or whatever. So I went over there and explained to him. I said, look, we would be more than happy to have them in our building. But people are much more comfortable being in a neutral location. Oh, he didn't understand that, but that was fine. When I talk to my compatriots out in the field, they say that many soldiers are uncomfortable being in an AA meeting on post. So luckily, we have some very strong, for example, the local Catholic Church at West Point, right outside the gate, has a meeting and has a very strong sponsorship program, and they do that there. Now, there are other places that we can't do that, because down in Afghanistan, or Iraq, or wherever we are this week or next, there are probably not those local meetings. But I can tell you, I have been to places. I've been to Bosnia, I've been to Kosovo, and, you know, there are signs up. I'll close with this. When we were on a ship one day, my wife and I, now that we're retired, we go traveling, and I walk in, and there's this sign on the board, and my wife says, well, I know what Red Hat is, but she says, what's this Friends of Bill W.? And I said, Ruth, Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, why did they say that? And I said, well, sometimes the Friends of Bill W. is a much more, you know, easy way of saying that. So you're out there. And if you're not next to an installation, you know, try to help those soldiers and veterans coming back through American Legion, through Veterans of Foreign War, maybe your local VA clinic. You know, I know you don't go out and solicit support, but being there helps a great deal. And if people know you're there, you can help the situation by helping our soldiers. Our soldiers have, unfortunately, Dr. Joyce has said, our problem with the Army regulation is we talk about our program as a manpower conservation program, and it is. But in terms and times of downsizing, it's used as an Army elimination program. I wish it was different, but it's not. Okay. The last time somebody asked me about the regulation in terms of separation, and they said, well, why did you write it this way? I says, I didn't write it this way. It came from the Secretary of the Army's JAG, and we were told exactly what to put in. We fought it, but it doesn't happen. The good side, though, is sometimes commanders have compassion and common sense. And sometimes they will use the regulation as a guide. Many times I've been told an Army regulation is not federal law, and it's not. And so while it says thou shalt do this or thou will do this, some commanders have the flexibility. Sometimes that works for us. Sometimes that works against us. But if you are in a situation, education is a key, and just being your presence is here. Being here today has been probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, because AA has saved many people in my family, and I've never been able to thank all of you for doing this. So thank you for what you do and who you are. Thank you.
Let's thank all three of our presenters with another round of applause.